we are all trying to be responsible. And to say, like, meet yourself with compassion for a lot of people feels reckless. It feels like you're letting yourself off the hook.
Exactly.
And we don't want to do that. We want to get better. We want to improve, right?
I need to be nice to myself.
I know, right? Especially perfectionists. Perfectionists are like, I am going to become the best version of myself.
Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten, and today you may notice that I am also solo. And this is not a situation where I kicked Julian out the group. I did not pull a Beyonce, nor is this some sort of announcement around our breakup. This is really just us trying something new. It's Women's History Month, and as we were thinking about topics, there were just some topics that I related to differently, dare I say, better than he did. And instead of trying to figure out how we could create a shared voice or how we can position the questions in a way that gives him some time to talk and me time to talk, we just decided that, like, what if we tried me doing an episode by myself? And so that's what we're doing. Today we're talking to the author of a book that I read a year ago called The Perfectionist's Guide to Losing Control. And I took the cover off because it got ruined through all of my page flapping. But it was a book that really just broke my brain. It was a book that I just found so valuable. And I've been wanting to talk to her about it since then. So today we have Catherine Morgan Schaffler on the podcast, and she is going to walk us through so many frameworks. She is going to debunk the myth of perfectionism being something that we need to recover from. And look, I'm not saying that if you are not a woman or a perfectionist that you won't be able to relate to the episode. I think there's something in there for everybody. But if you have found yourself calling yourself a recovering perfectionist or identifying as a perfectionist, this is definitely an episode that you're going to want to tune into, and hopefully it goes well. It's my first time as a solo episode, and if we like it, then maybe you'll see more, and maybe you'll even see Julian doing an episode of his own. So stay tuned. I hope you find it as valuable as I did.
It's nice to meet you, finally.
Same. I feel like I know you. You've been in my head for months, years at this point. I read your book at the beginning of last year. So that was, I get my years confused because of pandemic time. But I think it was the beginning of 2023. I like to start every year with a book that kind of breaks my brain. And I wasn't expecting yours to do that, but it did. And it's so, like, marked up now. I don't even know. Like,
oh, my God.
Cover, and it's got, like, all these highlights and things in it. And
oh, that's the best. I love that. You know, everyone says, like, seeing your book in an airport or something. I don't think my book is in any airports, but in a bookstore or whatever is, like, the best. But to me, I'm like, that does nothing. But seeing people mark up the book is special to me.
Yeah. Me too. And I know that there are some readers who are precious about their books. Like, there are some people who don't even like to crack the spine. I'm a spine cracker. Like, it's ASMR to me.
Oh. I tear apart my stuff. Man. You can't even open it. It's like, I don't know if you use the notepad in your phone, the notes app. It's like, God help me if anyone reads my notes app. God, same with the margins of my books. I think it's like a nod to the author that you're so inspired to, like, get all that stuff going.
I love an ugly book. It's like the one area of my life where I am not a perfectionist because I will write all up in it. So thank you for joining me. I'm so glad to be doing this with you. I did an intro that introduced you separately, but I also mentioned that this is the first time I've ever done, like, a solo podcast. It's a very new thing.
Like,
the reason I wanted to do it was because, one, it's Women's History Month, and I just, your book is tailored towards women. It's not something that men can't benefit from, but it was so eye-opening to me as a woman. And there are just some things that I relate to differently than Julian. And, like, I just felt like this needed to be a me and you conversation. So I'm going to try.
I'm so happy about that.
Yeah. So I want to jump right in, if that's okay with you. I'm already recording, if that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get specific about some of the reasons why your book was so powerful to me. And I think it was the first time that I saw perfectionism as a true strength. Like, I had been teetering the line using career advice where it's like, it's a strength in these areas, but a weakness in other areas. And you were the first time that you were the first person that said, it's not something that you should be recovering from. Like, it's truly a gift that is supposed to be managed and not necessarily destroyed. And so I wanted to start off by just talking about the difference between unhealthy or maladaptive perfectionism versus healthy or adaptive perfectionism. If you can just give the listeners and the viewers the difference between the two of those things.
Absolutely. I think it's a great place to start. So I'm a psychotherapist by training. And I wrote about perfectionism because in all the different clinical contexts I was in, you know, I worked on-site at Google as their on-site therapist. I had a private practice on Wall Street. I worked in a rehab. I worked with kids in residential treatment who had really been severely traumatized. Perfectionism came up in all of those places. And perfectionism was both the thing, particularly in rehab, the thing that, you know, grabbed people by and held them by the ankles and really chained them into a narrative of limitation. And it was also the thing that ushered people towards a new, better, different level of still who they are, still the same being, but just a more truer, authentic version of that thing. And so I was really caught off guard by that, because I had heard the same narrative that everyone else has heard, right? Which every self-help book is like, perfectionism is bad, and therefore if you're a perfectionist, you're doing something wrong and you need to be doing something instead.
Yes.
And that's a really dangerous directive, actually, because perfectionists experience that identity as an enduring identity. So in the same way that like a romantic feels that they're romantic for their whole life, or an activist feels that way their whole life, an artist, you know, there are some identities that are more fluid than others, and some feel like such a core part of who we are. And you know, there are exceptions to every rule, but generally perfectionists feel the latter, which is like, I can't help but push. I can't help but want more. I can't help but poke the bear. And I think it's such a wonderful energy. So the book, The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control, is about getting people to understand that perfectionism is not a personality trait. It is a power. Just like the power of love, the power of wealth, the power of art. It has a dichotomous nature. Any power can be used constructively and destructively, right? Wealth can be philanthropic, or it can really exploit people. Yeah. Art can add beauty. It can really objectify. You know, all these powers need to be managed in order to be used in a way that gives you energy, in the healthy, adaptive kind of way you're talking about. So the research world uses those terms, adaptive and maladaptive, to explain the two types of perfectionisms that I kept seeing in my practice and in my clinical work. And basically, there are two guiding questions to ask if you want to know if your perfectionism is in a healthy place. It's, how am I striving? And why am I striving? So the how is like, are you striving in a way that is hurting yourself or people around you? That's unhealthy, right? Or the healthy version, are you striving in a way that is giving you energy? And yes, even though your work does make you tired, because we're human beings and being tired is a natural daily experience, is it also giving you energy, making you feel more curious, more alive, more like yourself, more like you are animating who you are in the world, you know? Then that's healthy. And the why are you striving is, are you striving because you feel like whatever is at that finish line for you, when you cross that finish line, then you're going to be able to feel something that you don't have access to now. Or then you're going to be able to call yourself something that you can't call yourself now, right? Yes. So then I'll be able to say, I'm smart, I'm successful, I'm beautiful, I'm a good mom, I'm a this, I'm a that. So if you're striving in a way in which you are in waiting, and the waiting is going to be finished by achievement on some metric-y level, you know, like as soon as I'm a New York Times bestselling, whatever, then you're really making a bargain trade, which is hurting you, which is saying, I'm not going to feel any joy now. And I'm going to expect that the joy I feel later is going to make up for the fact that I'm leading a pretty miserable life. Mm. And miserable, not in the like crying, bawling your eyes out every way, but miserable in that, like, I mean that in a literal way. Like, do you feel alive in the world?
Exactly.
Yes. Like, when's the last time you laughed?
Yeah.
Do you, right. Can you taste the food you're eating? Like, do you feel alive? Do you listen to music or whatever? Everybody has different stuff that helps make them feel alive. But like, I fall prey to this all the time where it's like, wait a minute, I don't even remember how I spent my morning because I'm just being a machine right now. I'm just doing. Let me like sink deeper into my life and actually enjoy it.
Yes, girl, like I'm going to pull on all of those threads because you just said so much. And there's a lot that I want to talk about in this conversation, because as I was reading it, and I have a bad habit of seeing things through the lens of money and finance, even though it doesn't necessarily call for that. But this was so spot on. I saw so many parallels between the hundreds of conversations that I have with women about money and wealth and mm-hmm. this fluid concept of perfectionism as the thing that might be holding them back in different places. But I love the way that you described perfectionism as this powerful energy and how, like you mentioned, every type of power, if you don't know how to harness it, it can really ruin your life. Yeah. I feel the same way about money. I think it's a powerful energy that if you don't know how to harness it, can really mm-hmm. limit your life in a different ways. At the same time, we're on the cusp as a country of one of the greatest wealth transfers that we've ever seen, where women are going to be the beneficiaries. They're going to inherit over $30 trillion over the next decade, which is a wild twist of events, given that we weren't even able to build wealth a couple of centuries ago. Yeah. I'm curious if you see or how you see the role of wealth or money on this path of self-actualization or aliveness. Do you think it can be a tool for our empowerment without falling into the traps of perfectionism? Or is mm-hmm. it something entirely different? Do you see any overlaps?
I see a total overlay. I think they are inextricably not just related, because it's like they're one and the same. And I just answer that question from a personal level. I have had to really, maybe more than anything else, and in a way that surprised me more than anything else, really navigate my relationship with money and wealth and understand the depth of that and understand its connection to my sense of not just safety in the world, but my sense of accountability. I mean, when you ask me if they're related, I'm like, they're central.
Yeah.
They're central. And I used to really be afraid of that power of like, well, I don't want to be wealthy because that's, first of all, I just had this culturally, you know, trained idea that that makes you bad.
Yeah.
Also, I thought for me, I'm just speaking for me, my fear of that power of money and managing your money and making money and being accountable kind of represented a lack of trust in myself. Like, if anybody's going to be wealthy, it should be me, because I am a good steward of finances and I am a generous person and I am not somebody who is going to, you know, be wasteful. I mean, do we all have lessons to learn and did everything start out that way? No, but you know, like this is a really truncated, condensed version that I'm telling you of like my money. I hate the word journey because it's so like,
I know
your eyes, but like it is that. And it's about like self-worth and do you believe you deserve this amount of money? And what does that represent to you? And perfectionism and money are so interesting because I talk about this a lot in the book. So many of us are chasing wants that someone else told us we're supposed to want.
Hello. Yes.
And the times in my life when I felt most wealthy are times when I'm able to afford, for example, to eat really well, Like, I remember when I was on my social work salary, which was $41,000 in Los Angeles, which is like enough, kind of. But it's like, I hope I don't have like a, nothing can like happen. Anything. Like, yeah, basically nothing. It's like, you know, it's like if you break your arm or something and have a medical bill, it's the kind of thing that stresses you out, you know?
Exactly. Where,
and I remember once I started making more, the first thing I did was put fresh fruit in my fridge. And that felt like so luxurious to me because I was like, before I was like, I'm not paying $8 for these grapes. Meanwhile, by the way, I'm like going to a clubs and spending like $15 for drinks. So, you know, it's all
different.
you know, it's in my 20s, you know, but it's like these sort of parameters we put around money are so much in our minds.
Yes.
It's just like perfectionism, you know, and because perfectionism in its unhealthiest version is about limits. Limits on what you're allowed to feel and who you're allowed to be until you earn it, until you earn it by this culturally sanctioned way. And that's not real. It's not real.
Or is it? It's not freedom. Like it doesn't, it completely restricts you. And I think that's what I found so freeing about it is because I had been naming the problem differently. I had been thinking it was something wrong with me instead of this larger thing that is capping everything that I believe is possible because I feel like I'm stuck in this rigid way of being, which is, it was a huge unlock for me, especially when you outline the five types of perfectionism in the early stages of the book. And I agreed with several of them. Like many people, I saw myself in a lot of them, but the main ones that I saw myself in were the procrastinator perfectionist, where I experienced this level of diminishing returns because of my perfectionism. I become indecisive, or I just become like frozen in time. I can't decide how to act.
Yeah.
And then I was also the messy perfectionist where I loved starting things, but then I would struggle to stay focused on the goals and just, you know, stick to whatever I committed to. And those two traits, those two patterns buck up against so much of good investing advice, which is to start early and then just keep on, like stay consistent over time. Yeah. It can really feel like this upward battle where I'm managing these two tensions that are evergreen. They're always there. Do you have any advice on how to reframe the tension? You talked about how perfectionism is kind of like being a romantic, where it's just ever present. But do you have any advice on just how to like throttle it back at times when you know that something that you want to do requires it to be a little quieter in the background?
Yeah. Well, I wrote those five types not to say, here, keep an eye out for this tendency because it's bad and you shouldn't be this, but to say, here is a pain point for you. And here are your strengths, because each type has a strength and a pain point. Procrastinator perfectionist, for example, does want the conditions to be perfect before they start, but they're also incredibly thoughtful people. They are not impulsive, which is such an asset. And once the project gets going, those are the people who carry it through the tedium of the middle and can really see it till the end. The point of the five types is to understand where your pain point is, what's really effortless for you, and then seek help and connection for people whose pain points are the opposite and who can effortlessly help you in the places where you're experiencing weakness, right? So a procrastinator perfectionist who's like, God, I don't know where to invest my money. I don't know how to think about this. I'm planning, I'm doing all this research. I have these like 10 options narrowed down. If you get someone who's more of a messy perfectionist in the mix and ask them for help and you accept their help, then they're going to be able to do the thing that you are struggling to do, which is just pick something.
Right?
Like you got to pick something. They're going to be able to pick something. They're going to be able to do that with enthusiasm, be so excited. It's contagious, a messy perfectionist energy. You're going to feel it and then you're going to do it. And then the messy perfectionist is going to go away because they are start happy and they just like starting stuff. And then you're going to be there with all your gifts and talents to see that thing through. And you know what? If you discover something that you couldn't have known in the beginning, which was this was the wrong decision, you will course correct. And that comes back to trusting yourself. It's like when we talk about investments, money, you know, whether we're going to buy this house or do this thing, it's like we talk about trust in this singular moment in time. Like, I need to trust myself to make the right decision. That's not how I see trust, especially when it comes to finances, because it's like the same thing with relationships. Like, how can you know? There are so many factors at play that you just cannot predict or control. So it's like, trust yourself to make the best decision in the moment. And then if you realize at some point it's no longer the best decision, or you become aware of information that you weren't privy to before, trust yourself to pivot.
Yeah.
So the goal of that framework of the five types of perfectionist is like, instead of trying to take our weaknesses and churn them into strengths so that we can be strong at everything and good at everything, which frankly is impossible. That's not going to happen. Just understand, I'm so good at seeing stuff through. I'm so good at preparing and thinking about stuff. God, I am bad at executing. Let me get some help from someone who's good at it. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. We just need to connect to each other. I don't know if you and your partner have like complementary
sets,
you know, but like usually people naturally gravitate towards people who are sort of like, it's that old saying, opposites attract, you know, where it's like we are naturally inclined to seek out people who like we can help and who can also help us.
Yeah.
And I think that's beautiful.
I agree. Is it natural to feel like you're one type of perfectionist in one area of your life, but maybe a different type of perfectionist in another area? Because I can hear people that might be listening to say, I'm all over it at work. Like, I am type A. I get things done in this area of my life. But when it comes to finances, I'm completely different. It doesn't transcend.
100%.
I can't take those skills and transfer them.
Yeah, perfectionism is fluid, meaning you can be an intense perfectionist, which is someone who wants the end to be perfect. So you're fixated on an outcome. You can be an intense perfectionist at work and come home and it looks like your house just got ransacked,
right?
Because you're not a classic perfectionist, which a classic perfectionist is the archetype that we most think of when we think of perfectionism. It's that kind of like preppy, everything's in a row, sort of infusing beauty and structure naturally all around them are the strengths of the classic perfectionist. So yeah, I mean, if we bring this back 30,000 feet in the air, like all mental health is fluid in a way that we're not recognizing in current culture. Like even something like depression. If you are in a depressive episode, it's actually pretty rare, unless it's a severe, severe episode, that you are feeling that depression all the time. Like some people paint or go for a walk or they're around a person and something lifts in them. Right. And they, if you were to take a marker of that moment in time, would not be depressed. Right. And so, you know, we speak about personality types and mental health in patterns because we need the language of that to help us organize it, but it's really actually quite fluid. Right. And so, yeah, your perfectionism comes in and out and waxes and wanes. And everyone who's hasn't read the book is like, so am I a healthy perfectionist or not? And it's like, let me kill the suspense. You're both, I'm both, we're all both, depending on what's going on around us. And like, right. did you get sleep this week? Because if you didn't, you're at risk of a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's just keep it light of like being more irritable, of making impulsive decisions, of doing this, of doing that, of falling into maladaptive perfectionistic tendencies where you're just trying to get the thing done and you don't care if you're like short with everyone around you, or it's not even worth the money that you're investing more money in it than you're actually making.
Yes.
But you just need to get it done because that's going to prove something that you got it done. It's like, you know, this stuff is very fluid.
Yeah, I feel like the framework that helped me embrace the fluidity of it all was when you talked about the difference between goals and intentions. You said that sometimes that you can honor your intentions without hitting your goals. And that paradigm shift was key for me because it was a matter of making sure that I'm equipping each goal with an intention. Do you think they should always be created together, or can you have one without the other in general?
You can have one without the other. If we're going to have one without the other, I would choose intention without the goal.
Yeah.
I think goals are really helpful in of giving you a place to look at, for lack of a better way to put it. Intentions are the things, it's the reason behind your striving. And the goal is what you're striving for, right? So if your goal is to be married and you have no intentions fueling that goal, then you can get married tomorrow. You know, it's like if the intention is to find a partnership with which you can enjoy honesty, freedom, love, and stability, then you can fulfill that. And you may or may not get married to that person. It's not really going to matter that much.
Right.
You know, whenever I hear someone be like, oh, you're married for 20 years, what's your secret? I'm like, hold on. Are you even happy is what I want to know. It's like so often we crown the goals, right? We're like, oh, you made six figures, or you made seven figures, or you did this, or you've been married for 20 years, or you lost this weight. It's like, how did you feel in that process?
Yes.
And does it feel like you're being more of yourself as you move towards that thing? Or have you gotten all this money and accrued all this wealth and you don't even know who you are anymore? You're a shell of yourself, you know? And so really, if you don't have intentions, you're really going to drift. Mm. And we don't want to drift.
No.
Because, you know, when you feel untethered from a sense of who you are, like you start to dissociate a little bit from your life. Can't really form relationships from that place because nobody knows who to link into. You know, you start to not remember how you're spending your time. You're like, it could be Tuesday or Thursday. You know, you're just not oriented to anything without intentions.
Yeah. That's a great segue because I want to double click on what you said about self-worth. And I want to talk about spending as a form of self-worth. There has been a recent study that said 39% of people are emotional spenders, meaning they spend in order to feel something different. And there's even been this new term that's been created, doom spending. I don't know if you've heard of it, but it's basically this collective thing that we're doing as a country where we're spending money as a cope. We think that we'll feel better if we buy something. We'll feel better about the uncertainty, all the tragedies of the world if we buy something. And so we do. And I really like the way that you talked about self-worth and presence in the book. And I'd love for you to share more because I think one of the first steps in determining what's important to you and worth spending money on, which is key for establishing a budget, is to know what you value, is to know what you really appreciate. Mm-hmm. How do you think self-worth or a better understanding of self-worth can help us get clear on setting good financial goals or even intentions?
Yes, it's such a great question. So people confuse self-worth and self-esteem a lot. And self-worth is what you believe you deserve, right? So self-worth is like, I believe I deserve reciprocity. I believe I deserve love, friendship, play, pleasure without having to earn it. You know, I think there are five things that we never have to earn in this life. And they are love, connection, dignity, joy, and freedom. If you're a human being, you should never have to earn your freedom. You should never have to earn dignity, which to me is different than respect. Respect is earned, in my opinion, but dignity right. is like, I'm going to treat you like a human being. You should never have to feel that you earn your way to love. And so those are my five pillars of self-worth. Self-esteem is what we think about ourselves. So self-esteem is like, I think I'm a really good public speaker. I think I am bad at soccer. And self-esteem comes and goes depending on what we're doing. It's context-based. So you can have really low self-esteem about something, but still have high self-worth, right? And you can have high self-esteem and think, I'm hot, I'm smart, I'm wealthy, I'm this, and have low self-worth.
Right.
And still don't feel like I deserve that stuff. And I think sometimes we spend as a shortcut to self-worth when there is no shortcut to self-worth. And we spend and it moves the needle in our self-esteem. Like, okay, I think I'm more successful now, or I think I look better now because I bought this thing, or I think my house is more beautiful. But that has nothing to do with your self-worth. That has nothing to do with what you believe you deserve. And what we spend on, not just money, but spend time, energy, thoughts, ideas, affection. What you spend all those things on matters, because what you spend on is a reflection of your self-worth.
Yes.
And it can be a reflection of your self-worth to say, I'm not going to spend money on this car that's technically a nicer car, because spending that money on that's going to make me feel anxious about having enough money in my savings, right? So when we're spending from a sort of self-esteem place, we're like in the shallow mindset of like, I deserve it. I'm going to get the super nice thing because I have worked hard and I deserve it and I earned it. And so you spend without necessarily thinking about what that's going to cost you.
Yes.
Right. And so, you know, when people are really secure in their self-worth, they have nothing to prove.
That's it. That's it.
So they're not trying to be all, you know, like outward and showy. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't be those things and that everyone who is being fake in some way. I don't think that's the case. I mean, some people just really love this sort of like pageantry of being a human and kind of like getting dressed up and doing this and doing that. And that can be fun and that can be great if it comes from a good place. There are no shortcuts to self-worth, and you just can't buy your way there. And we get that intellectually, but we forget, you know, it's hard to remember sometimes. And the more like tired you are, and the more you're, you know, engaging with toxic people, and the more you're eating shitty food, it's like the easier it is to forget what you already know.
Yes. You know? Yes. That's like, it's the perfect segue. I'm going to just keep using perfect because
okay, I'm into
that's
it.
How this conversation feels. But mm-hmm. I think of self-sabotage or self-punishment as the other side of the coin of self-worth. Yeah. And in your book, when you talk about self-punishment, you say that when we're engaging in our lives punitively, it's often unconscious and it just registers as this feeling of stuckness, of feeling stuck. Nine times out of 10, we know exactly what we need to do to improve our lives, but we struggle to do it because we're engaged in this cycle of self-punishment. Can you explain that a little more and then offer any tidbits that you may have to get out of the cycle to just start doing what we know we should be doing?
Yes. So if you're attached to your self-worth, which is I deserve, you know, all of the things that I mentioned a few moments ago, and you make a mistake, right? You don't suddenly say, okay, now I don't deserve reciprocity because I made a mistake, right? You still know you deserve reciprocity, love, freedom, dignity, all that stuff. And instead of punishing yourself, you respond with compassion. So let's just like bring this to example world. Let's say you're on a budget and you know you're not supposed to be spending, you know, any more money than you've already spent that week. And it's Friday, you already bought groceries, you're on your way home and you're like, I'm just going to pick up food because I'm tired and I can't. And so you spend however much you spend going to a restaurant or picking up food, whatever. If you are attached to your self-worth, you say, I understand that I am a good person who is moving in the right direction. And mm-hmm. that direction means that it's like climbing a mountain. It's like that, you know, you go up, 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 you fall a little bit because you pulled on the wrong thing or because you get in the process of things. Sometimes it is one step forward, five steps back.
Yeah.
And you don't allow those five steps back to be a commentary on who you are as a human being and what you deserve, right? Mm. So in that budget example, it's like you wake up the next day and you have two choices. You can punish yourself or you can meet yourself with compassion. And punishing yourself is usually unconscious. It doesn't look like, you know, you hurting yourself in some literal way. It looks like really punitive self-talk, which is like, see, all you had to do was eat the groceries that were already in the fridge and look what you did. Look what you did. You're never going to get it together. You don't deserve any of this stuff. You didn't earn it. You don't deserve the safety of financial freedom or the peace that comes with that. Like, sorry, you're going to have to work harder and do better because you're just not there yet. And in the moment, that sounds like discipline. That sounds a lot like responsibility. That sounds like I'm going to be accountable. I messed up and now I need to, you know, do some version of emotionally whipping myself into shape so I don't make this mistake again. And that's the goal and insidious nature of punishment. The idea is I'm going to make myself feel so badly about this that I never do it again. And actually, when we think about the times that we have made the strongest, best, healthiest, boldest, most generous choices, it's because we felt strong. It's because we felt good.
Yeah.
When you make the bad terrible, you know better, you've known better choices, it's because we feel weak and we feel in pain and we are in some level of despair in some way. We just don't feel like our best selves. So we just, you know, hit the what feels at the time to be the easy button. And then it causes so much more pain for ourselves. And so the reason that people do this is because it's like, we're all trying to be responsible and to say like, meet yourself with compassion for a lot of people feels reckless. It feels like you're letting yourself off the hook.
Exactly.
And we don't want to do that. We want to get better. We want to improve, right?
What do you mean I need to be nice to myself?
I know, right? Especially perfectionists. Perfectionists are like, I am going to become the best version of myself, you know? And it's like, that's great. And this is why I spell out in The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control the difference between punishment and discipline, personal accountability, rehabilitation, and natural consequences unfolding. Those four things are very different than punishment. All those four things I just mentioned, they work. They're highly effective, right? Punishment doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The only goal of punishment is to create pain. And people often push back on me with that. Like if we use kids as an example and you have kids and they're not supposed to eat cookies in the pantry before dinner and they eat a cookie and you hit them, then they do learn not to eat a cookie, but they learn not to eat a cookie when you're there. Right. And they don't learn why they're not supposed to eat cookies. So sometimes punishment does work to deter the behavior, but it seems like it does, but it actually, we just avoid the source of the punishment. That's what happens when you punish people and punish yourself, is you don't learn anything. You learn to avoid the source of the punishment. And if you're the source of the punishment, then you know what you learn to do. You learn to numb out.
Yes.
So back to our example, it's like if you're going to give yourself this punitive self-talk of, God, is it that hard to cook the food that's in the fridge? Really? It's that hard for you? Great. Well, then you deserve to feel like shit. It's like if that's your grand plan strategy, then what's going to happen is the next day you wake up, you're going to want to avoid that voice. And so you numb out. And you know what that looks like? Being really busy, watching Netflix, drinking too much alcohol, overeating, starting some drama that you don't even care about just because you just need a distraction. So much of this is unconscious.
Yes.
So it's really important to learn the differences so that you can ask yourself, am I being punitive or am I creating discipline? You know, discipline also seeks to extinguish negative behaviors, but discipline seeks to do that through the promotion of positive behaviors, which is why it's different than punishment. And when you're disciplining yourself, you're approaching your life with this great strategy of, I'm going to make it as easy for me to feel strong and good as possible, because that's when I make the good choices.
Yeah.
You know, that's not what punishment does. Punishment's just like, I'm going to make you hurt, period.
Right. Yeah. And that explains why I've never really related to the term discipline. It's never felt like an emotion that burned clean in me. Like whenever it comes up as like a required thing, I'm just like, oh, well, count me out. Because when I think of discipline, I think of being a drill sergeant to myself. And I'm already a drill sergeant in so many areas of my life. It's like to add another one just feels like too much. So the idea of trading it or swapping it with self-compassion and focusing on positive momentum is huge, and it will probably unlock some things that I've been avoiding because they quote unquote require discipline that I haven't tried this newer, dare I say, softer approach with.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is a really good marker that you're bringing up of like, does it feel good?
Yeah.
And if it feels good, you can trust it. And that is the opposite of what we're, the message we're getting. And like, I think language is such a landmark for me. It's like a lighthouse where the difference between two things blurs the more your stress response is activated. So punishment and discipline are really going to get blurry, and standing up for yourself and being passive aggressive is really going to get blurry. It does for me anyway.
Yeah.
And so the difference between like immediate gratification, feeling good, and actual pleasure, like that helps you become disciplined, is in this model called the AER model. I think this is going to be really helpful for your listeners, especially if you're having those problems where you're spending money trying to feel better and you can't tell if it's because you're like, I'm trying to give myself what I deserve, or am I taking a shortcut? It's like, this is a good litmus test. The AER model, by these brilliant researchers who determined that happiness and pleasure is not just experienced in the moment, in the event, which is the E part of the AER model, it's also experienced in the anticipation of the event and in the recall of the event, right? And immediate gratification, I realized, doesn't have the same three-stage process, right? So if something is a real pleasure for you, like you really love getting up early in the morning to write your book for 2 hours, then that is going to be a pleasure to think about doing. You're anticipating it and you're like, oh, I can't wait to do that. I love it. I'm going to have my tea, light my candle, whatever. And when you recall it, it's also going to feel good. You're going to be like, I'm so glad I did that. That set me for the whole day. If we're talking about immediate gratification, let's keep using a buying. I'm going to switch up the example just because we're talking about money stuff. So the sweater, right?
Yeah.
Buying the sweater is going to feel good in the event if it's immediate gratification, which is a shallow version of pleasure. So you're going to be like, ooh, I got a new sweater, da da da, this is great. Anticipating it is not always going to feel good. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like, I know I shouldn't buy a sweater, but I really want one, but let me not spend too much on it. And hopefully I just walk out of there with one thing, fingers crossed.
Right.
And then you recall it and you're like, oh, I wish I wouldn't have done this because now I'm stressed out about how to pay this other bill. And so if you're having a hard time and things like me get blurry for you sometimes, really using language to delineate, is this pleasurable for me or is this just cheap immediate gratification? Because the immediate gratification is going to distract you from being the person you want to be and getting the goals done that you want to get done. The pleasure is never a distraction. Pleasure, it only moves you closer to what's right for you.
Yes. Yes. Oh, there's so many places I could go. I'm going to try to squeeze both of these questions in the last couple of minutes that we have together, because I want to talk about the financial concept of enough and how difficult it is for women to define what is enough, what it means for them in a society that's constantly moving the goalposts. And when you've got all of these other external factors, whether it is, you know, other people's goals or expectations of you or your own ebbs and flows of perfectionism going on, do you have any advice on how to get clear on what enough means for an individual?
Yeah, well, for me, I always start when I'm trying to identify what something is, I always start at the perimeter of what it's not. So like, what's not enough for me? Is it not enough that I only have 1 hour to play with my kids in the day?
Yeah.
Is it not enough that I can't afford healthy foods that came from the earth? Is it not enough? And some of the reasons why we don't have enough are systemic. And that can feel really hopeless because it's like, well, I can't do anything about that. You know, the way that I think about that is it is still useful to understand that it's not your fault that you're hitting up against why some of this stuff is not enough. It's like the difference between internalizing something and saying, if I could just figure out the right life hack, then I wouldn't be having to deal with this. That's not true. This is a systemic issue. Anybody in your position would be having to deal with it. The call's not coming from inside the house.
Hello.
And like that just frees up some energy
for
you to pursue what is going to be yourself for that, which is community and connection. And by community, I don't mean you need to find 30 people who are all in the same mind. I'm talking about one neighbor who you trust to swap childcare protocols with, right? Of like, listen, this Saturday, you take them for 3 hours. Next Saturday, I'll take them for 3 hours. And it's all this stuff isn't going to singularly be a huge difference, but it is going to release you from the energy of thinking that it's you, right? That like you're the one who can't figure it out and you just need to find the right formula. Like there is no right formula to deal with a level of cultural dysfunction that's happening in our country. And yes, that's like the bigger picture stuff. The little picture stuff about enough is like, once you figure out what's not enough, then figure out like what is enough on a survival level. And then also what makes you feel good. We're back to pleasure and the power of pleasure. Like it's not enough for me to not be depressed. I want to lead a joyful life. Okay. So I know what's not enough. That's not enough, that feeling of kind of like empty, going through the motions, death by paper cut lifestyle. Now, what do I also want more of? And what would that look like in my daily life? There's a great exercise. I'm just going to take up the whole rest of the time with this one answer. There's a great exercise. I have a value list in the book, The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control. And values are tough because when you're asking yourself things like, what do I want? What would enough look like? There's so many things we want to say yes to. It's like, if you look at a value list, it says things like kindness, loyalty, adventure, you know, playfulness, generosity. It's like, I want all of the above. But you really have to pick and focus in order to get what you want. And so if you take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle of the paper, and on the left-hand side, you pick three, four, or five values that are really important to you, right? And then on the right side of the paper, just write one tiny example of what that value would look like animated in your everyday life. Because the thing about values and those big capital underlined italic questions of like, what do I want? What's enough? They're so overwhelming because it's like, I don't know everything, not this, you know, it's like, we don't know where to start. And so if you pull it down to like, let's say freedom is a value of mine. So I put it on the left. It's like, okay, I want a life with freedom in it. And what does that mean? What that might look like. One example of the right side of the paper would be that I wake up and the next hour belongs to me. I get to decide whether I want to stare out the window, paint my toenails, start writing my book, do this, do that. I get to decide. I own my time.
Yes.
Right? And so you go down the list of your values and you write on the other side what they look like in everyday life. And look, if you can't do this instantly, it's okay. Like give yourself a week or two. This is not all going to come immediately. Like, as I say to myself all the time, I'm going to delegate that to my subconscious. And then, this is a big one on the back of the paper. Flip the paper over and write what you no longer value or actually never valued.
Ooh.
Right? Yeah. And so maybe propriety is on there. So a lot of people value propriety. They want to show up. They want to look a certain way, speak a certain way, give the impression of a certain thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. Zero judgment to any of these values. We're all different people. We're all going to value different things. But understanding what you don't value is really helpful sometimes in reframing what your life actually looks like, right? Yes. So when I don't value propriety, and so, and I have a small child, for example, and one of the things I do value at this moment in time is playfulness, especially with her. So you might come over and my house might be messy in certain rooms, all the rooms, or, you know, it's like,
and I'm when in the I same look stage.
At, right? When I look at that mess, if I don't understand like that, I don't value propriety and everything being in proper order at all times. And I don't understand what I'm valuing instead. And that playfulness costs you mess sometimes. Then I can easily look at the mess and feel like I'm failing. Because I'm like, what? I just like, I have a house cleaner, right? Like yeah. She just came. It's only 3 days later. Like, what? But then it's, so the more that you can get clear about what you value, what that looks like in your everyday life and what you do not value, how what you don't value also shows up in your everyday life, then you're able to see things that in a less conscious space would make you feel really like you're failing, and you're actually able to see those things not just as not failing, but as succeeding.
Yes. Yeah. You actually answered the last question just then. I was going to say how the last chapter of your book, Now That You're Free, was the one that had me thinking about legacy. And I was going to ask how women should approach legacy in a way that balances what they value and their desire to lead a fulfilling life today versus this idealized state in the far distant future. And that exercise, which I'm definitely going to do today or tomorrow morning, it does it. Like it helps you get clear on the things that you value at the moment, the little ways that you can have that reflect and show up in your daily life, and the things that you're letting go in order to make room. And I just, that's such a powerful concept. So thank you for squeezing that in.
Oh, my pleasure. And thank you for all of these thoughtful questions. When I think about money and wealth and so much of my goals around that in the past have felt like a sacrifice until I'm like, no, actually I value this freedom. So spending, you know, $60 on this sweater that I think is cute is actually not going to give me that. Cause then I have to work more to get it. And what I'm buying when I don't buy the sweater is like hours of time. And that feels luxurious. And so they're all so connected. And I think, you know, in order to be our full selves in the world, we need to operate from a place of wealth and abundance.
Yes.
And if you're not operating from that place, it can be really hard to like be who you are, you know? And so nothing is like, there's no magic pill and there's no silver bullet, but really, I really appreciate your work because I think it is like the final frontier of feminism in a way of like, okay, now how can we do all of this and be really financial independence has so much to do with people's sense of personal autonomy, self-worth, decision-making. It's so right there. So thank you for the work that you do and for inviting me on this hard won platform of yours. This is such a wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, I always say, and I'm quoting a colleague, it's hard to be a feminist if you're broke. So thank you for coming on. You are officially one of my favorite psychotherapists, which I always tell people not to judge me for having favorite psychotherapists. But please tell people where they can find you if they want to keep up or if they'd like to buy A Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control.
Yeah. So you can go to my website, KatherineMorganShaffler.com. I'm also on Instagram at KatherineMorganShaffler.com. And the book is The Perfectionist Guide to Losing Control, A Path to Peace and Power. It's available on Audible, eBooks, hardcovers, all the places that you buy books.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.